Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest, the author of many things, including the brand new book, Evidence for Christ, How We Know That Jesus is the Messiah, also the man behind Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. He told us last hour, 422 episodes have now dropped. 400, that's not how many have been made, that's how many have been dropped. I know that he stays ahead of it, so there's...
Got several recorded that haven't dropped yet.
Really? Do you, how far do you try to stay ahead? Do like five or six or two?
I'd like to be eight ahead. I'm not currently eight ahead, but we're going to get back to eight ahead very shortly.
You know something I've never asked you about, but so you've done all these hundreds of episodes. Like, are there particular episodes that you could think of where you're like, oh, but new evidence has come to light in that one I did before? I think you did
I've done update episodes before and where I update, here's what's been discovered since we did it last time.
Yeah. All right. Jimmy Akin, I'm senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, and your help with your questions today. If you've got one, you're welcome to call. Whatever it is, it's Ask Him Anything, 888-318-7884. Thomas in Memphis has been waiting a while, and I thank you so much for waiting, Thomas. Go ahead with your question.
Well, thank you. I did have one question. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Get right up next to that phone and lay it on us. What's your question?
And if you're using speakerphone, take it off speaker.
Could just be the Tennessee phone company.
Is that better?
Oh my gosh, that's better, Thomas. So much better.
Yeah. All right. Tip for the audience: when you're calling a radio show, never use speakerphone.
All right, Thomas, we're ready.
Sounds good. All right. So, well, my first question, I didn't run it by the screener, but it's kind of important to me. Si, have you started watching Fringe yet?
Fringe? Oh, no.
So that's for you, Si.
I forgot that. Yeah, we had talked about that with Jimmy one day, and Jimmy recommended it, and I have not started watching Fringe. All right, I'm going to send myself an email while you're talking to Jimmy. Thank you for reminding me of that, because that came with a recommendation. Jimmy liked the TV show Fringe, so yeah, I got to catch that.
Very well done. All right, Mr. Akin, my question is, where did the church fathers get their physical copies of the Hebrew Scriptures?
Amazon.
But it was literally Amazon at the time.
They had to go all the way to South America?
No, it was where the Amazons lived. I'm sorry. I just shouldn't have gotten involved. Go ahead, Jimmy.
They got their physical copy. Now, when we say Hebrew Scriptures, we got to clarify what you mean. Do you mean Scriptures that were in the Hebrew language or just copies of the Jewish Scriptures, regardless of what language they were in?
Copies of the Jewish Scriptures.
Okay. Well, so the very first Christians were Palestinian Jews, and they spoke Aramaic, and so most of them were not literate. There were a few, though, who were, and they would have had Jewish scriptures that they got in Hebrew that they got from Jewish sources. Just like other Jews who happen to be literate, and Palestinian. They also could have had access to written copies of what are known as the Targumim or Targums, which were Aramaic translations that were often read in the synagogue in Palestine. And so they would have gotten those from Jewish sources as well. When it comes to slightly later Christians, after the church became dominantly Greek-speaking, well, they used the Septuagint translation in Greek, and no matter which language they were getting it in, they would have gotten it the same way that everybody got books in the ancient world. You borrowed the book from someone who had it, and then you paid a scribe to make a copy for you. And so early Jewish Christians would have gotten their copies of the Jewish scriptures from either in Hebrew or Aramaic from other Jews, and then had them copied. Jews and Gentiles that didn't speak Hebrew or Aramaic would have gotten the Septuagint from presumably initially other Jews that had them, and then they had scribes copy them for them, but it would have been the same process by which you got any book in the ancient world. You borrowed a copy and then had someone who was a professional, usually a professional scribe, not always, but you had someone who functioned as a scribe who made a copy for you.
Okay.
Okay. My question is, you've answered my question very well, but it seems odd that the Jewish authorities who would have, you know, something so, you know, special and expensive would just lend them out to someone from who you could argue would be a competing sect.
Well, by the time that Christianity was viewed as a competing sect, the cat was out of the bag. I mean, Christians already had Jewish scriptures. So, initially during the ministry of Christ itself and for some time thereafterwards, Christianity was viewed as, you know, a Jewish group and not necessarily a Jewish group in conflict with the authorities. In fact, there were members of the authorities, like the New Testament talks about Pharisees who became members of the Christian sect, and priests who became members of the Christian sect. And, you know, a lot of them would have had copies or access to copies. Local synagogues also wouldn't view Christians necessarily as an opposing sect. And a lot of them would have had, or I mean, at least Christians who had writings, some Jews who already had the writings then became Christian and brought their writings with them. So they had, you know, access to these things.
Fantastic.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Thomas. I'll tell you what, you did wait a good while, and I'd love to send you a copy of Jimmy's new book, Evidence for Christ, How We Know That Jesus is the Messiah. It's available anywhere where you get your books, but you're getting it for free if you just give us an address, and we will send it off to you. We'll do a little bit of early break, Johnny Versillo. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll come right back and get lots of calls on for Jimmy Akin. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Ask him anything. Continues right after this.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily Mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Beyond Damascus with Dan Demite and Aaron Richards is our show for young adults.
Everybody's talking about encounter. Everybody's talking about that mountaintop experience. What we fail to often talk about is what happens after. What happens beyond that Damascus moment?
Jesus Christ is calling all of us to be missionary disciples, disciples of Jesus who are on mission to bring the kingdom of God here and now on this earth.
Beyond Damascus with Dan Demite and Aaron Richards, tomorrow at 8 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Yeah, we talked about the Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World podcast, but we didn't get to the Jimmy Akin podcast. And it is a world of riches when it comes to Jimmy Akin. You get one at the beginning of the week and one at the end of the week. And what dropped on Monday on the Jimmy Akin podcast, Jimmy?
It was episode 88 of the Jimmy Akin podcast, and it's all about what the number of Christ is. People know that the number of the beast is 666, but very few people have, in our world, have stopped to think, well, what would the number of Jesus be? Mm-hmm. But this is something that people in the ancient world would have thought about. Because for them, every letter of the alphabet had a numerical value. So you could look down and see the letters A, B, and C, or you could look down and see the numbers 1, 2, and 3. Because their A, B, C's and their 1, 2, 3's were the same written system. Mm-hmm. So any letter that was written down was also a written number. And so ancient Christians did, and we can actually show this from first and second century sources, did think about the number of Jesus. And it's a very interesting number. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you know what the number of Jesus is, it's like, which came first in Christian imagination, the number of the beast or the number of Jesus?
Right, right. That's episode 88 available now at the Jimmy Akin podcast. Go ahead, Jimmy. I'm sorry.
Coming up this Monday after this weekend, I have an episode where I have an ecumenical dialogue with Austin Suggs of Gospel Simplicity about purgatory and indulgences. And he's coming from a Protestant background. Specifically, he's Anglican. But he's coming from a Protestant background. I'm, of course, Catholic. And we end up agreeing about purgatory and indulgences. So it's a very interesting dialogue.
And that you're saying that will drop on Monday?
On
that
one. This coming Monday.
All right. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts or Jimmy Akin's YouTube channel. All right. Let's see. Where are we going? We're going to Great Falls, Montana. Happy that you're here with us. Stephen from Great Falls, go ahead with your question.
Yeah. Hey, Jimmy. I appreciate you guys taking my call today.
We're happy to.
So I have a little bit of a different question. I have been in a dialogue with someone who is claiming biblical subordinism. I've never heard of it before. He often refers to himself as holding to the eternal submission of the Son. So he's claiming that Christ is fully divine because he's begotten of the Father. But yet he also says that the Son doesn't possess everything that the Father possesses, like omniscience, and that the divine nature is communicated from the Father by historical begetting. And it seems to me like, because he completely regards the Nicene view of the Trinity as a heresy. Mm-hmm. So I've been in this debate dialogue with him. And I guess my question is, from our perspective, how can we best defend the Nicene Trinity from someone that is more along the lines of semi-Arianism? Because I've never had to deal with that kind of conversation. My parents are Protestant, so authority topic comes out a lot, but I've never had to try to debate the Trinity before.
Okay, let me ask, does this individual you're having the dialogue with, does he belong to any particular church?
That I don't know. It was actually in a debate group that I'm a part of, and his challenge was that no one could explain the heresy of the Trinity by only using the 66 books of the Protestant Bible. And then by asking questions is when it kind of seemed to lead towards him essentially saying, and I asked him and he never responded. He just kind of walked away from the conversation. The classic question of, are you saying that there was a time where Christ did not exist? And he kind of shrugged his shoulders and walked away.
Okay. So the reason I ask,
I've looked online at the website. Yeah.
The reason I ask is I'm trying to understand, you know, in order to help you as much as I can, it would help me to understand where this person is coming from. There are groups like, for example, the Jehovah's Witnesses who could make claims similar to this, but it also could be that he's just freewheeling his own theology. So to know whether he's part of a tradition that teaches this or if this is an idea he's read about or developed on his own could help me out. But since you don't know, you don't know. So I'll do what I can. So the first thing to say is it sounds like the concept he's referring to is subordinationism. In other words, that the Son is subordinate to the Father. And he's objecting to the Trinity, if I heard you right, because it teaches eternal subordination of the Son to the Father, whereas he believes the Son became subordinate at the incarnation. Is that right, or have I misremembered what you said?
No, so he's gone on, and I wrote down like the basic things that he's denied. One is numerical identity, that they share the same divine essence. He denies that. He also has denied that and defined that the Son's divinity is just granted, or rather, quote-unquote, communicated by the Father, and distinguishes that he's the source. And then ontologically, he's insisted that the Father and the Son don't possess all the same attributes identically.
Okay, well, it sounds like he's advocating, well, I'd have to know more about his view in order to put him in a specific category. The way to argue for the Trinity using the Bible is, and it doesn't matter which canon you're using, you know, whether it's the 66 book Protestant canon or the 73 book Catholic canon or the even bigger Ethiopian canon. What you need to do in order to show that the Trinity is true is show that the Father is God, the Son is God, the Spirit is God, there is only one God, and the Father, the Son, and the Spirit are distinct. And there are passages in Scripture, particularly in the New Testament, that can be used to document each one of those claims. For example, Jesus is called God repeatedly in the New Testament. One example would be, you know, in Romans, where Paul says that Christ is God over all. And similarly, in other Pauline epistles, it says that he had the very form of God, and he had equality with God. Now, taking those terms at face value, well, okay, equality is equality. Sykelet, if you have two human beings and they're equal, so they have equality, does that mean they have the same attributes?
No.
Like intelligence, will,
and yes, in that
physicality?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, okay. So, so if God, the Father, has certain attributes like omniscience and omnipotence and things like that, and Jesus had equality with the Father, then Jesus is going to have omniscience and omnipotence and things like that. What your friend is going to have to do to get out of that is then try to carve out unstated exceptions and say, well, it doesn't mean full equality. It means something less than full equality. And it doesn't mean he's fully God. It means he's something less than fully God. But at that point, your friend is not taking the language at face value. And if you're not taking the language at face value, then you need to provide evidence for why it shouldn't be taken at face value. You also are going to need to explain the problem that Jesus said he was going to guide his church, including in its teaching ministry, until the end of the world. You know, he says that in Matthew 28. He says, go among the nations, teaching them whatever I've commanded you, and I'll be with you until the end of the age. So Jesus indicated he was going to be guiding his church, including in its teaching. And in John's gospel, particularly in John 16, he talks about how the Holy Spirit is going to lead the disciples into all truth. And he talks in Matthew 16 about how the gates of hell will not prevail against his church, which means his church is never going to die. And since his church embraced the Trinity, and there are no surviving non-Trinitarian sects from, you know, the early days of Christianity, then his church would have died, and it would not have been guided to the end of the world by Jesus and the Holy Spirit. So in addition to the exegetical problems in trying to get around the plain language of Scripture, he's also got an ecclesiological problem of how do you get around the promises that Jesus made about his church if you want to advocate this theory. So that would kind of sketch what I'd have to say in response to him. But like I said, I'd need to know more about exactly where he's coming from in order to tailor the argument more specifically.
So we will leave that there. Stephen, thank you very much for the call. Off to back to Tennessee. We've been to Tennessee a couple times a day. Andrew is in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, watching on YouTube. Andrew, welcome. Go ahead with your question.
Hello, Jimmy. Hello, Cy. How are you guys doing today?
Very well, Andrew. Thank you.
I'm doing okay.
Okay, great. Well, I'll go ahead and get to my question. So it's about the Ghostbusters.
I know. Finally. I know, Jimmy. Finally, a Ghostbusters question. It's almost, we're almost through the whole show. All right, go ahead, Andrew.
Okay, yeah. So I know, Jimmy, you make an important distinction between ghosts and demons. And yep. I believe some of the creatures they fought in the movies are actually demons. So my question is, are the Ghostbusters good, and would they need ecclesiastical permission to do what they do because they're dealing with departed human spirits and, in some cases, demons?
Okay. The so in regard to the first question, are they good in the movies? In the movie, well, yeah, they're good guys. The movie, they're the protagonists of the movie. They're trying to help people. They're trying to prevent people from being harassed and attacked by spirits, whether they're human or non-human spirits. And so, yeah, they're good guys. In terms of would they need ecclesiastical permission to do what they do, well, it depends on what you're talking about. The church has no regulation. Now, you mentioned a distinction between human spirits and demonic spirits, and the way that term is used in official context today, it refers to a fallen angel, which is not a human. It's been used other ways in other periods of history, but today it means a non-human spirit. Well, the church doesn't have any regulations on what to do regarding how to alleviate harassment from human spirits. So, you know, trapping them in an electronic device is something that doesn't work in the real world, but it works in the fictional world of the movies, and the church doesn't have any regulations saying you can't do that. So, they wouldn't need permission to do that unless there are different ecclesiastical rules in the fictional universe than there are in the real one. When it comes to demons, in the real world, it's required that if you want to do a major exorcism, that you have to be in the Catholic Church, you have to be a priest who's been specially commissioned by a bishop to do that. And so if we assume the same rules are operating in the world of Ghostbusters that operate in our world, well, then the Ghostbusters would need to be priests, and they need permission from the local bishop to be able to do a major exorcism, but they don't do major exorcisms in the movie. I don't recall them doing any kind of exorcism, although it's been a long time since I've seen it, so I can't say for sure. But unless you're doing a major exorcism, there's actually great liberty. People who are not priests with special permission from the bishop can do minor exorcisms. They can do deliverance prayers. And if they can do those, then they could also trap a demon in an electronic device, which also doesn't work in the real world, but apparently does work in the world of Ghostbusters. And certainly if a demon like Gozer the Gozerian shows up and is threatening New York City, then you've got a necessity defense too, of we've got to save all this human life and we got to do it right quick, so we better summon the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man and hope that works. Or we better cross these streams and make sure that we get rid of this horrible supernatural threat. We ain't got time to get permission from the local bishop. Necessity requires that we take action now. So they'd also have a necessity defense.
Okay, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of, on the nitty gritty details, you kind of fumbled it a little bit, because the demon god took the form of the Marshmallow Man, and they were fighting the Marshmallow Man in the movie.
Yeah, that's not why Dan Aykroyd's character summoned the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. It wasn't a fumble. It was a joke.
Andrew, hang on. We'll send you Evidence for Christ, Jimmy's new book. I got to take a quick break. Right back with more Jimmy Akin.
Who was Jesus? It's the most important question in the world. Was he a great teacher, a religious myth, the Messiah and Lord? In Evidence for Christ, apologist Jimmy Akin builds a powerful step-by-step case from history, scripture, and reason, showing that Jesus is the fulfillment of prophecy and the risen Lord. Get your copy of Jimmy Akin's Evidence for Christ today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
The world has a lot of questions about Catholicism. It's a big faith, and it deserves a big book of answers. Well, now it has two. Get the Big Book of Catholic Answers, Volume 2, and have 300 clear, reliable Catholic answers right at your fingertips whenever something comes up at work, with friends, or around the dinner table. Order your copy of the Big Book of Catholic Answers, Volume 2, at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Have you ever wondered about the mysterious, even obscure aspects of the Catholic faith? Dive into the Jimmy Akin podcast, where Jimmy brings together information from many fields as he pushes the boundaries of apologetics. Tune in today to the Jimmy Akin podcast, Mysteries of the Faith, a highly entertaining, informative, and at times humorous show that will help you grow in your faith. Visit JimmyAkinPodcast.com today to subscribe.
Why do we baptize? Does it really do anything? In Baptism Now Saves You, Dr. Carlo Broussard explains the unbreakable relationship between baptism and salvation, making sense of the Church's teachings in a way that is easy to understand and ready to share. St. Peter said, "Repent and be baptized, every one of you." Discover what that means today. Order your copy of Baptism Now Saves You at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Johnny Vercello spinning the records in there. Thank you, Johnny, for the groovy music. Jimmy Akin, our guest, phone number 888-318.
Records, how old school.
Yeah, it is. Johnny's 18. He's probably going to have to go look that up. What does that mean, spinning records? I have no idea. Look it up on the internets there, Johnny Vercello. Not while we're doing the show. 888-318-7884, the number, off to Pleasant Grove, Utah. We go where Ryder is watching on YouTube. Ryder, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, I recently watched the film Silence by Martin Scorsese, and in this film, the main character is a Jesuit priest, and he has to, or at least in this scenario, he has to lie and denounce Christ in order to save a group of Japanese Christians. Ooh. So from a Catholic perspective, is it ever okay to lie or to denounce Christ if it's to save somebody's life?
Okay, so there is no single answer to the question of is it okay to lie. There are different opinions on this. According to a prominent strand in Catholic theological history, it is never okay to lie. This view was advocated, for example, by St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas. So it's got some quite respectable advocates who favor it. On the other hand, it is by no means universal. There's also a view which has been held, including by some very recent popes, that acknowledges it is sometimes legitimate to lie in order to achieve goals like saving human life. And then they have different theories of how do you account for that. So, for example, Pius XII during World War II, authorized the fabrication of false baptismal certificates so Jews could pass as Christians to escape Nazi and Italian persecution. And during the authoritarian regime in Argentina, Pope Francis, before he was Pope, told lies in order to similarly save people from government oppression. So there is this alternative view. Then you've got a question of how do you account for it? And one proposal that's been made is you're only obligated to tell the truth if the person you're talking to has a right to the truth. So if they don't have a right to the truth and you've got a compelling reason why you need to lie to them, it would be okay to lie to them. Or, depending on how you define lying, you can tell a falsehood to them, expecting them to believe the falsehood, but it wouldn't technically be lying because they had no right to this information. That's essentially a semantic question. My own theory is that lying is a form of damage that you do to another person. To give a fancy philosophical term to it, it's a form of what you could call doxastic damage. Doxa means belief, and so it's a form of damage to someone's belief system. And so if you lie to someone, if you feed them false information that they knowing that they're going to believe it or hoping that they're going to believe it, what you're trying to do is damage their belief system. And so I would argue, this is just my personal view, but I would argue that there are situations where you can damage a person's belief system in order to save human life, just like there are situations where you can damage a person's body in order to save human life. You know, I could, if the Nazis come to my door and want to know, do I have any Jews there, and there's no way I can get out of it without lying, or attacking the Nazis physically. Well, if I could attack them, if I could kill the Nazi and damage his body that profoundly, I would say damaging his belief system to where he just believes there are no Jews in my attic is a less serious form of damage than killing him. So I would say I could lie to him in order to save the lives. Although, again, you could quibble about should we call it lying at that point. However, I would say there are some, in my view, there are some lies that can never be told, just like there are some occasions where killing can never be done. You can kill an aggressor, but you cannot kill an innocent person. And in the same way, you can damage people's belief system about a lot of things, but one of the things you can't do is denounce Christ, because that it fundamentally misrepresents God and man, and specifically the relationship between you and God. And Jesus has made it clear, and the New Testament makes it clear, if we deny him before men, he will deny us before his Father. And that makes it sound like it's a mortal sin to deny the Christian faith. So I haven't seen this movie. I don't know what the circumstances were. I would say my personal opinion is that there are situations that could justify lying, but I would not be comfortable saying that there are situations that would justify denying Christ, even when human life is at stake. Christians are called upon to be willing to be martyred themselves. And I would say, on my view, that we have to be willing to let other people be martyred too, rather than deny Christ.
What do you think, Ryder?
Thank you. That makes sense.
All right. I have not seen the movie, but I heard it's a pretty rough movie.
Yeah, it is.
Pretty brutal.
It's about, the Christians are dying in Japan, and he has to denounce Christ to save them. So you answered my question perfectly. Thanks.
Wonderful. I won't ask you if you want it. I'll tell you, you can have it. Evidence for Christ, How We Know That Jesus Is the Messiah, the new book from Jimmy Akin. If you hang on and give us an address there in Pleasant Grove, Utah, we will send it off to you. Allison's next in Midland, Texas. Glad you waited, Allison. Thanks for doing so. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, hi. So my question is, when did it first start in church history that popes, monks, and nuns started taking on a religious name that was different from their birth name?
Well, it was different depending on what group you're talking about. If you're talking about like monks and nuns, people in religious life, then it began between the 300s and the 500s. So you could say the 400s plus or minus a century. But it's hard to date precisely because it wasn't universal. It's not like there was a ruling and, okay, starting tomorrow, we're all going to have new names. It was a practice that was adopted here and there, and it took a while to become standard. When it came to popes, that's easy to date. The year that happened was AD 533. And the first pope to take a new name was John II. And we even know why. It's because his birth name was Mercurius. And Mercury was a Roman god. And so Mercurius, when he was elected as pope, didn't want a pope to have the name of a pagan god. So he adopted the name John, and he was the second person to have that name as pope. So he became known as John II. Even then, it didn't become common. That was kind of a one-off. Now, actually, I should mention not everybody had Mercurius's opinion on this matter. There was a previous pope named Dionysius, and Dionysius is also a pagan god's name, and he didn't have a problem, just like there's the evangelist in the New Testament, Apollos, who's named after Apollo. Well, he didn't feel the need to change his name as a Christian evangelist, and Pope Dionysius didn't feel the need to change his name, but Mercurius did choose to. But that was kind of a one-off, and it really didn't become common for popes to take new names until about the year, it was right before the year 1000. And then as soon as it started around the year 1000, that's when it really locked in. And basically almost every pope since then has taken a different name upon becoming pope.
Okay. Allison, that makes sense to you?
That's fascinating. I never knew too much about, why, people would end up
changing those names.
Well, basically, it's a symbol of your new life in God. So, in a monastic context, you're kind of saying goodbye to your old unconsecrated life by taking on a new name that symbolizes your consecration to God as a religious person. And you could read the papal custom similarly, although it's not as fleshed out. And I suspect it was also influenced, because you notice how it catches on all of a sudden around the year 1000. Well, by that point, you had lots of Christian monarchs in Europe, and monarchs frequently take new names when they become the reigning monarch. And I suspect that royal custom may have had an influence on why it caught on with popes in the Middle Ages, but I haven't researched that question, so I don't know that.
Allison, very grateful for the call. Thanks for waiting. I know you did. I'll send you a copy, if you'd like, of Jimmy's new book, Evidence for Christ, How We Know That Jesus is the Messiah. Give us Darren will pick up in a sec. Give us that address and we'll send it off to you. We're going to take a very quick break. There's a couple lines open. If you've got a question for Jimmy, we'll do our very best to get you on with him. 888-318-7884.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Alexian Brothers is a proud sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. For 800 years, these Catholic brothers have offered a prophetic and daring response to the gospel. Serving Christ in the sick, the poor, and the dying. Is God calling you to be a courageous disciple? If you feel called to total self-giving as a religious brother in the mission of Jesus, call our vocations office at 847-264-8703. That's 847-264-8703. AlexianBrothers.org.
EWTN, teaching the truth.
I love listening to EWTN. I feel like that's one of the sprinkles also that helps keep the Catholic faith alive.
I want to say I'm very thankful for the explosion in Catholic media in the past 20 years, Catholic radio all over the country, incredible grace in my life and helped me in my reversion.
Hi, thank you. I'm a first-time caller.
Thank
I really
you
love
so
your
much.
Show and your passion for God's people, so thank you for that.
It was this late in the show. I'm looking at the clock here. Man, it flew. It flew. Lots of great questions today. Jimmy Akin, our guest. More questions, welcome. We'll try our best because we do have a bit of time before the end of the hour. 888-318-7884. Ask him anything. And off we go to Lowville, New York. Jeffy in Lowville. Thanks very much for the call. Jeffy, welcome.
Thanks a lot. Basically, I was curious because it seems that Romans 4 conflicts Catholicism quite a bit.
Okay, why would you say that? By the way, are you using a speakerphone? Because you're kind of breaking up.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, please take your phone off speaker.
Okay.
And then, Jeffy, what about Romans 4 would seem to contradict Catholicism to you?
It teaches faith alone, but...
Mm-hmm.
And so, and in Catholicism, you also...
Does it?
Next to faith, you also need... baptism.
Go ahead.
And the Eucharist. And
okay.
Also works, too. Because the Bible also says that faith without works is dead.
Okay. So you've raised about four issues there. Let's go through them one at a time. The first thing you said was Romans 4:5 teaches faith alone. So let's read what Romans 4:5 actually says. Romans 4:5 says... but to the one who does not work, but who believes in the one who justifies the ungodly, his faith is credited for righteousness. Okay, now the translation you've read from, Jeffrey, may be a little different, but, you know, it communicates the same basic content. You said that this passage teaches faith alone. Where is the word faith mentioned in that verse?
It's not just that specific verse. I was talking about the whole chapter. I think you misheard me.
Oh, well, maybe I did. In any event, Romans 4:5 does not teach faith alone because it doesn't mention faith alone. And in fact, Romans does not teach faith alone. You know how I know that? Because Romans and every other book of the New Testament except the book of James does not use the formula faith alone. That phrase occurs once in the New Testament, and it's in James chapter 2, where it's rejected as a description of how we're saved. You have other passages that say things like man is saved by faith and not by works of the law, but it doesn't say faith alone. And so that's reading into the text. That's a practice known as eisegesis. That means reading into the text. And it's not the way we're supposed to handle the Bible. We're not supposed to read into the text. We're supposed to read the meaning that is in the text out of it. That's called exegesis. Now, so Romans, whether you construe it narrowly as Romans 4:5 or more broadly as the whole book of Romans, it never teaches faith alone. You do have statements like, and this is paralleled in Galatians, about man is justified by faith and not by works of the law, but it never says faith alone. So that's just not taught in Romans. Now, let's suppose it was. You said that conflicted with Catholicism, the idea of faith alone, right? You said that, Jeffy? Want to make sure I understood you?
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I've got some news for you. That is not a problem for the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church doesn't have a problem with the idea of justification by faith alone. In fact, Pope Benedict XVI, back in the year 2008, gave a speech in which he commented on the fact that Martin Luther's formula, faith alone, is true as long as you mean the right kind of faith. So there's different understandings of what faith is, and as long as you understand faith correctly, the Catholic Church doesn't have a problem with the idea of justification by faith alone. Popes themselves, like Pope Benedict, have said that, and Catholics in history have used the formula faith alone. The idea that Catholics do have a problem with this is a mistake, and it's a mistake that's particularly common in the Protestant community, although it's also a mistake that's made by some Catholics, but it's actually not true. The Church never condemns the formula faith alone. What did happen about 500 years ago was a church council, the Council of Trent, condemned one understanding of that formula. But if you read what they said carefully, it's very clear they're only condemning one understanding. So, even if Romans did teach faith alone, the Catholic Church wouldn't be contradicted by that. The Catholic Church has no problem with that formula as long as you understand it correctly. So that's one of the issues you raised. You also raised baptism in the Eucharist and works. Okay, well, let's do those quickly because we're getting close to the end of the hour. Okay, the Eucharist. The key question, actually, I need to bracket all three of those with, is the question, does it happen before or after you enter a state of justification? Like, do you have to do good works to get into a state of justification, or do good works flow from a state of justification? Well, the Catholic Church actually teaches you don't. Now, there's two points to make. The first one is Paul is not talking about good works in Romans, not in this passage. He's talking about overwhelmingly works of the Mosaic law. That's why he keeps referring to circumcision. Circumcision is not a good work, but it is, it's not a work of moral value. It's a work that is done to obey the Mosaic law. And that's why Paul keeps talking about the circumcised and the uncircumcised. But even if you were to grant the idea that he's talking about morally good works here, the Catholic Church doesn't teach that you need to do good works in order to get into a state of justification. In fact, it understands that you can't do good works to get into a state of justification. In fact, the Council of Trent, that council I mentioned before, says nothing that precedes justification, whether faith or works, merits the grace of justification. So on the Catholic view, good works are something that flows from the state of justification. They don't get you into it. And that's actually agreed upon by people in the Protestant community. You don't do good works to get into justification, but as Paul says in Ephesians, God created us in Christ so that we would do good works. So they flow from our justification as Christians. So once again, this doesn't, what Romans says doesn't conflict with what the Catholic Church teaches. Then there's the Eucharist. But do you have to receive the Eucharist? Cy Kelly, you can help me out here. Do you have to do the Eucharist? Do you have to receive the Eucharist to get into a state of justification?
No.
No. So it's not a good work that precedes justification. It's something you do after justification. So again, there's no contradiction with the Catholic Church here. Then, Jeffy, you mentioned baptism. And baptism is something you do in order to be justified, at least in the ordinary course of affairs. But is baptism a work that earns anything with God? Or is it a gift that God gives us? Cy Kellett, why don't you tell me, if I get baptized, am I doing anything that God owes me for there?
I was 8 days old when it happened to me, Jimmy. I was definitely not a work that I was owed anything for.
Yeah, so it's not a work that earns anything. And you know who else agreed with that was Martin Luther. And so when you've got clear passages like 1 Peter 3:21 saying baptism now saves you, it's not a work. It doesn't earn anything. It's just doing what God says to do, and that doesn't mean you're earning anything. So in none of these passages, and Martin Luther and other Protestants would agree with this, in none of these respects does Romans 4:5 or the whole of Romans contradict Catholic teaching. What would you have to say about that, Jeffy?
I'd say that helped a lot, actually. That helped my understanding.
Wonderful.
Good. Also, now I think Cy's going to give you a book here, but I want to give you one too. I did a little short book called 20 Answers, Faith and Works, and I'd like to offer you that as well. It sounds like you're a young gentleman, so you may need to get permission from an adult to give your address, or they can give your address, but we'd be happy to send you both 20 Answers, Faith and Works, and my new book, Evidence for Christ.
Jeffy, I'm going to go quickly just to get another caller on, but thank you, and hang on. Give us an address if you can, and we will send those off to you. Sean's right here in San Diego watching on YouTube. Sean, as you can hear, we got to go quickly. Can you?
Yes, super quick.
Yep.
Hey, Jimmy, just curious what your thoughts are. Can you
yes,
hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, just curious what your thoughts are on simulation theory and if the church has any teachings or guidance on it, and then your personal opinions on it.
Well, the church has no teachings or guidance about simulation theory, so it's all a matter of opinion. What simulation theory, and I'll tell you mine. By the way, if we get cut off, I have dealt with this on Mysterious World before in episode 17. So if you go to mysterious.fm/17, you can listen to a whole episode about this. Having said that, what simulation theory essentially proposes is what the stuff of the universe is made out of, at least the physical universe, because that's all it can deal with. But the Catholic Church has no teaching on what the stuff of the universe or the physical universe is made of. I mean, it's conventionally called matter, but there are different theories about what matter is. And there have been different theories that have been in vogue at different times in Christian history. In the ancient world, a very popular theory borrowed from Greek philosophy was that it's the four elements, air, earth, fire, and water. These days, we have the atomic, a refined version of the atomic theory of matter. What the simulation hypothesis proposes, it's essentially patterns of energy running on a server somewhere, but none of those theories are impossible. I think we have good evidence for the atomic theory of matter. I don't think we have good evidence for simulation theory, but even if it were true, so what? We've still got immortal souls, even if they're clothed in patterns of energy running on a server somewhere. But check out episode 17 of Mysterious World.
And thank you for being quick, Sean, to say thank you. I'd like to send you a copy of Jimmy's book, Evidence for Christ, How We Know That Jesus is the Messiah. Just hang on and give us an address. That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.